destroying the entire universe.
Welcome to Radio Free Deimos, an Ix und Draconis podcast transmitting from ASAF Hall at Lake Voltaire on Deimos. The Deimos Board of Tourism just voted in our new slogan for the year. It's Wow, Deimos! But I like the first runner-up. Deimos, we just don't really know what to say. It just felt more honest to me, I think. Yeah. This week we're going to be dipping heavily into Jungian archetypes, so I'm going to open with a very simple question for the hosts. First off, what's your name? And secondly, warrior, magician, lover, or king?
Okay, my name is Wines, and I'd say lover.
I'm not going to argue with that.
Mer.
My name is Corbeau, and I'm going with magician this week, specifically the amazing Criswell, who is truly amazing, and I think his prediction about the metal-to-rubber ray that was going to destroy Pittsburgh was spot on. He nailed it.
And he was right. The future is where we're living the rest of our lives.
This presents a weird chronological paradox given this conceit that our podcast has. Ashtar, warrior, magician, lover, or king?
You know, I think I missed a reference somewhere. I would also go magician.
Okay, I respect your decision there.
More of the power behind the throne type of thing.
Yeah, meddling and pulling strings, that sort of thing.
Not actually having to get your hands dirty.
Oh, you're not doing alchemy right then at that point. You probably have both your eyebrows.
I would say that is doing alchemy right.
On tonight's episode, we're going to start with a question from the Discord chat, which is there room for humor in HSD? I think all of our answers are yes. And following that, we'll open up our topic for the evening, which is going to be character archetypes for HSD, drawing heavily upon Jung, because I don't think a Jungian podcast role-playing game topic has been floated before. Fun. And then we will go into what our hosts think is awesome this week. So I say we start with questions and opinions.
How can any race be so stupid?
Oh, don't ask me any questions. I'm just a hard hand just like you.
This week's questions and opinions topic is from Starkovsky, who on the official HSD Discord channel, link in the show notes, asks, I get the impression that the given material, the rule books and such, allow for a lot of leeway in gameplay types and styles, but the official content is generally dark overall in tone. Is there any hints of whimsy in the setting, or would such content be out of place in the narrative? The question he kind of elaborated on is basically, is there room for humor in HSD? Noting that his own story has a very different tone than the books and the novel and such. There's a lot of different directions the game goes in terms of flavor. Mm. So I'll throw it out. Do we think there's a place for humor in this game?
Well, the situational humor, I mean, the fact that there's non-anthro characters that exist in a high-tech world, that's situational humor. That's pretty funny.
Okay, so kind of the physical aspect of these characters that aren't quite made for their environment, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
We are handcrafted their environment in many ways.
Right out the gate, I'll say that the source material, while it treats with very heavy concepts, it does have a lot of horror built in, is not particularly humorous, but at the same time, it's not particularly dark either. Everything has a fairly bright and neon outlook, and it doesn't really delve into maybe some of the more dark and gritty Shadowrun style side of sci-fi. So just right off the bat, while it doesn't exactly invite humor, it certainly doesn't rule it out.
I feel like there's two very different narrative voices in the books. There's the voice in the first core rule books, kind of white pages, that's the introduction to the world, the breezy tone that the author establishes for the introductory text. But then we get to some places where there's more color and more novel style narrative, more hard fiction. And the tone there is much darker. I think the world that those produce is a lot more gray and ambiguous, as is the page and the typesetting. That's particularly true when you get into the previews we've seen from the upcoming lore book.
Now, that may be true. I haven't checked out the previews as of yet.
Ashtar, I will point out that I begged you to read them for the podcast.
Yes.
Okay.
I prepare poorly.
Okay.
Much like I run games.
Oh. The improvisational style at work.
At the same time, some of the elements that are the darkest, some of the elements that really would introduce some of the horror, be it the weird outside of reality types, or the stuff that is grown on Earth, or the things that Vitae has, well, they are all kind of rooted in memes that are coming from Reddit or 4chan. And so the root of these, while it is kind of horror, also becomes very tongue-in-cheek horror, or you cannot do Five Nights at Freddy's and go, oh, that's just dark. No, it's dark humor. Really,
I really have a hard time seeing the humor side of the Vitae zombies. They're pretty shambling horror monsters.
Oh, no, they're lightning-fast zombie horror monsters. Sometimes. You shoot them and they don't die.
It's a fast shamble.
They rip off their arm and attach a chainsaw. They're a brain that's sitting there squishing at you and looking at you with beady little eyes that won't die.
Yeah, it's kind of space orc technology, and orcs are hilarious.
I feel we have very different definitions of comedy here.
Maybe.
Later on in the discussion, Starkovsky clarified his point, because a lot of people were saying things like, well, there's plenty of horror in the game, and that is absolutely true. HSD's subtext is, in many places, Lovecraftian horror. But he points out that humor and horror are not mutually opposing forces, and you kind of look at all of the 80s comedy horrors, and that's clearly the case. Humor is the release of horror. The opposite of humor is seriousness, Starkovsky says, which makes a lot of sense to me, and I think that maintaining a tone of seriousness is really challenging in HSD.
Negotiating the fine print of every contract that you go on, balancing the books, accounting in the space age.
Blessedly, that is handled between scenes by a series of die rolls and does not require gameplay.
That would be very serious and unhumorous gameplay, though.
Also, the notion of the technology that melts when you don't pay for it, that's kind of right out of a cartoon.
Yes, you can download a car. Mm-hmm.
On the subject of pointless bean pushing, I've spent several days this week working on a article on stock trading for fun and excitement in HSD, because the game feels like it needed such a thing. I may be deluding myself. I do think there's something in a furry type game that lends itself to humor, and it makes it very difficult to escape that. Just playing the animal characters and the various stereotypes we've associated with them and the endless fox jokes, I think it's really hard to pull out of that mindset and to play the game totally straight and flat. It's not possible for me. I mean, dogs got a wag. Mm-hmm.
Well, it makes me think of, like, in ye old cinema, like 1930s, ethnic humor, and not just racist humor, but like ethnic humor in general, was just a thing. Like, what was that early sci-fi musical? Oh, I'm forgetting the name of it. It's a lost film, but is made in around 1930 about somebody who fell asleep for 50 years and woke up in the distant future of 1984, which was illustrated by reusing some of the sets for Metropolis. Hmm. And it was a love story and jokes about people that ate their meals on pills, and their names had numbers associated with them. But amidst all this stuff, which is not bad, the main character had this ridiculous Swedish accent saying Jompen Jiminy all the time, because back then that was hilarious. Well,
classic.
Yeah. There are reasons why that's not hilarious anymore, or why we choose not to go that way. But, you know, when it comes to animals, go for it. It's fine. I mean, say what you really think about lions. It's totally fine. No one's going to call you on it. No one's going to be offended. And also, this is a world no one really has an edge. There is no dark side of joking about wolves or lions, because, well, also they're just people like anyone else. And so it's a place where you can kind of make this racial humor in a totally innocent way.
I think there are some corps that really lend themselves to humorous play as well. The Space Police game you could play with IRFP is kind of a comedy genre on its own. And I'd point anybody that was interested towards the Bulldogs role-playing game, which is the Han Solo RPG of low-rent space traders. It's a lot of fun. Pulse, I can't talk about Pulse without making marketing jokes and big dumb jock jokes. It calls out for it.
Yeah. Well, so since HSD is not a fantasy game, we can pull in a lot of modern stereotypes and jokes and have fun with them.
See, that's kind of amusing because, well, I agree with you on Pulse. I see IRPF as one of the more serious corporations, kind of an interstellar mall cop. If you're going to pull humor out of it, it would be a comedy of errors or a physical comedy type thing.
Yeah, well, no, they're the solar system straight men. And that's part of the fun of the police trope is taking everything super seriously. Of course, we've made any number of Walmart jokes already concerning MarsGo. And they're like flying egg crate ships, weirdly modular, always slightly too boxy and big for the room. The only corp I'd have trouble playing for humor would be TTI because they're altogether too serious and tied to kind of the dark backbone of the entire campaign. There's mad scientist jokes and tropes and the absent my professor type things, but I just would have a hard time playing them for laughs.
I could totally see TTI being played for laughs. The angle that I would spin it would probably be more of a MASH type situation. People thrown into such a stressful and horrific thing that they just kind of go weird.
They've been cooking on Europa too long.
Exactly.
Also, think of the interns, the poor interns.
Nobody thinks of the interns.
We are going to need another Timmy.
Taking it back to the original question, though, I think a lot of the rules as written introduces a certain amount of humor that's not really in the narrative. A lot of the scenario books and the supporting fiction books don't really bring an element of humor into it. But I think humor really threads its way through the background fabric of HSD. While I could see easily someone running a game that is devoid of humor, that takes it very seriously, maybe focuses more on the space politics or the combat side, I think the default level of HSD does contain a lot of humor.
Yeah, it's kind of a pop culture saturated universe. It would tend itself that way. I think I brought up this campaign setting before, but one of my old favorites is Steve Jackson Games' Innomine, which is a tongue-in-cheek game of angels versus demons in a battlefield that is the world for control over humanity and heaven and such like. And it's originally a French parody, social parody game. The game has a lot of humor elements, but it's also very dark and serious. And specifically, it's written with the intent to be played as absurd or darkly conspiratorial or noble. And very clearly, the rules state, you know, take your pick. Here's the way you spin it in this direction. Here's the way you play it in that direction. You can look at the world as being intentionally comical and intentionally serious and take your pick or mix and match as you fit.
I also think for players living in the 21st century, we're used to futurism. We're used to getting it totally wrong. We're used to these notions of utopias or dystopias. And, you know, we smile. I mean, because on one hand, there's some truth to it, but we're always wrong and we never know what's actually going to happen. And so I think it invites some kind of smirking when you talk about the future.
What do you think will be the next obstacle the Earth people will put in our way?
Some recent changes to the Radio Free Deimos website. The single biggest news we have is that now we are available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So if one of those is your podcast distributor of choice, please log in, subscribe to us, find us. There will be links available on the front page of Radio Free Deimos and in the show notes, of course. News that's a distant second, we have been expanding the Radio Free Deimos fan material archive to make it more multi-author friendly. This week you added an article on a proposed Pulse subsidiary called Mode, which is focused on youth subculture and counterculture. We spent a lot of time during the holiday episode saying there was no counterculture in HSD, so this is kind of a response to that. Also posted an article on, let's see, just the structure and idea of mini-corps in general, and some other material as well. So check out the resources and recent articles, links on the RFD page.
We received messages from their spaceships. For a while, it came in as just a lot of jumbled noise.
Fair warning to our listening audience, I have tried to say the word archetypes at least 40 times this evening and have successfully done it twice, now three times. So eventually I'm going to give up on skipping over that and we're just going to plow forward.
We'll use the preferred southern thingy.
Archetype, archetype, archetype.
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 I'm not playing this game with you people. Originally, when we were first looking at the idea of doing a podcast, I sketched out a bunch of episodes in the character generation world, and this was one of the ones that I was most excited about, which is the idea of building character archetype around HSD and its tropes and its ideas. But a lot of that we covered in the Building Your Perfect Party episode, in particular the standard model characters you define in Star Trek or games like, in particular, the captain, the pilot, and other cookie-cutter characters that you'd see on every...
The bumbling robot that doesn't get pop culture references.
Right, that one, that intolerable one. So I want to steer away from that and look at more of a literary character story sort of focus. There is a Jungian researcher named Carol Pearson, who is a fairly big name in corporate processes and organizational consulting type worlds. She's written a book and several books, beginning with Awakening the Heroes Within, Archetypes for Personal Development. And there's a lot of spin-off websites of her research that are character archetypes, the Big 12, that sort of thing. And they talk about the caregiver, the magician, the warrior, the wizard, it goes on and on, not too long, as models for character journeys and models for developing yourself. And I think that would be a fun place, or a useful place at least, to start looking at character generation in this world. We've got about a dozen archetypes. I'd like to unpack them in as uniquely HSD a manner as possible and keep this moving as a quick little conversation. There's links to the What Archetype Are You quizzy quiz on the show notes and some more detailed references to how these 12 unpack and operate. We will keep it fairly surface and quick moving. The thing I like most about more Jungian story-focused archetypes as opposed to Star Trek characters is that they resonate well with real-world characters, and that makes them very different from the paper tiger character sheets that you get in Dungeons & Dragons. I find that more satisfying.
Paper tiger?
Did I use that wrong? It's a, I guess that's a literary term for an argument that doesn't really have any substance.
I was more interested because you're talking about tigers, but...
Okay, well, yeah, it's not lions. Part of the backbone of Pearson's ideas for archetypes is that these are character stories, so it's... In many ways, where does the character begin and what are their challenges and how do they wrap up their story? Where do they grow to? So some of these don't necessarily make sense out of that context. In particular, she's got one concept that's the orphan, which a lot of people that look at this as a list of character ideas kind of go the everyman hero route instead, but it's the same basic concept. That's a little more who are they rather than where are they starting. So far as this discussion goes, I'd like to begin with the idea of the innocent. In many ways, this is the lost and found child, a character who is somewhat naive, who's got ideas that are going to be challenged. Her story is ultimately about growth. It's about resisting growth as well, optimism in the face of hopelessness, traditional values in the face of rapid change, good cheer, idealism, utopianism. These are all character traits that sometimes wilt in the sun, but fundamentally this is a hopeful and young character.
What I'm reading here is mad scientist. I mean, mad scientists are very idealistic.
That's a really interesting idea, because I think a mad scientist is a very dark archetype. How is that an idealist one?
Well, some villains have their moment when they give the speech and they explain how they're going to solve all the world's ills and problems by doing X, because they have a very simplistic way of looking at things. If I just solve this one problem, then the world will be great.
You could put a positive spin on that with the sort of techno-utopian idea of someone who believes that the future can be answered in a single simple solution. That mm-hmm. question, that solution is science. That solution is progress.
Yep.
That sounds very much like Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog.
Which song in particular?
You know, and the humorous pop culture reference style.
Right. The hopeless naive character I'd carve out of this is the character that's baked too long in the Neuroplex, that's gotten a little bit addled from too much force training in the test tube and is not quite ready for the world. In the color text, they talk about how you can recognize a character that's baked too long because they're just not quite ready for this. I'm reminded of one or two of my friends that were homeschooled too long. But that's a very TTI thing, is the generation that's been kind of lost to forced learning.
Yeah, another modern interpretation of that would be the bean counter.
The bureaucrat type?
Yeah, yeah. That just wants everything to fit on the forms and has faith that if we can categorize this in one of these boxes and make everything add up, it'll all be okay.
The salary man that does the 10 hours work day every day, goes to the karaoke bar, comes home and doesn't wonder at all what else there is to the life, that suddenly gets yanked out of that and thrown into the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but thankfully we are dealing with potential heroes here, because these are PCs ultimately. The character that never stops being a bean counter is not the PC.
Yeah, but that could be a place to start.
Truth.
Of course, we are talking about
boxes,
archetypes.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a very core character to a lot of different sci-fi or video games. This is the character doing their daily thing. You see a day or two of that, you get the feeling of how comfortable it is, and suddenly their entire world changes because they've been abducted, the ship crashes or whatever, and now they're thrown into a much harsher world.
Yeah.
That is the story that is being followed.
Yeah, or the corporate stooge that finally sees what's behind the curtain. I've seen that one a number of times too.
The Last Starfighter.
I've forgotten that one.
Well, just the kid who's just every man, no one in particular, but he plays a video game really well, and that's the test to find out who on Earth can fight off the alien invaders.
Ender?
Sure.
We're getting into the Everyman archetype, which is number two on the hit parade. I want to pick one of my favorite ideas for this one before we close it, though, and that is the character that's just stepped off the Blue Sky. The Blue Skies are, if you're not familiar with the game, are kind of Macintosh store floating cities in the sky, 5 mile long space stations where everything is the ideal corporate showpiece world. And the characters are usually fairly privileged, but sometimes they have to come down to Earth. So that is a really great naive character to start a story with. Number two on the parade would be the Everyman character, who I think we were dabbling with earlier. Everymen are usually very egalitarian. They're out for connection and belonging and equality, but their story is hardship builds character. They're the person on the long journey to self-reliance. What's the name of the character in Big Trouble in Little China, whose name is eluding me at the moment?
Jack.
Probably Jack. I would accept that.
Sure, Jack. Yes.
Hero protagonist.
Well, they definitely have the chin.
And so I guess the difference is just being more empowered than the innocent.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And the innocent is about growth, but the everyman, which is in Pearson's original language is the orphan, is about connecting and reaching understanding and empathy. I mean, everyman is in a sense, well, the definition of the word is everyman. It's someone who we can all connect to.
Okay.
Egalitarian is the word that turns up a lot with them. They're about populism, about being a part of the community, which the innocent is kind of a standalone, is kind of protected from the community in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. The innocent, almost by definition, has been removed from their community.
Right, right. Either that's part of their ongoing story or where they started. I feel like in HSD, the everyman is probably a dog, but I'm biased.
I think a lot of the canines would fit very well in that mold, yes.
They're amiable and very people, and so are the weasels as well. The mustelids tend to be fairly hyperactive and out there and social. Another everyman character I'd love to see played is the Marsco evangelist, because you're dealing with the corporation that is the backbone of all of society and is the most modular and generic of all of them. It's kind of like trying to express Walmart as a brand, and I think that's a character with a long uphill road, but, you know, big wide smile as well. Marsco execs are known to be kind of surface, and you never really know what they're thinking because they're... their lot in life is corporate front man.
Or an example of a fake everyman or an affected everyman would be the media personality. Because when media people are interviewing someone, they're always trying to ask questions from, get the perspective for the everyman, even though that does not represent them.
So sort of a chummy and artificial version of empathy.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody that's kind of strongly anti-corp could fit this role as well, because anti-corp but pro the people, which is a little ironic in HSD when the people are made by the corporations and things like that. There's a very back and forth relationship, but a very proletarian, you know, up the populace sort of idea would be fun to play out and a good foil for the world as a whole.
This also seems to fall in with a lot of the mining junkies, or there's a very strong militaristic streak to it. You could probably fit this very well into a lot of the IRPF.
Yeah. Those are really kind of the working class heroes. What's that really great opening sequence towards the beginning of Titan AE where they're doing the asteroid mining? And I think we've already referenced that once in this podcast already, but it's one of my favorite scenes in
Spaceship Salvage.
Yeah, Spaceship Salvage. But yeah, getting your hands dirty and doing kind of physical labor in the great void.
I don't know why. Again, it may be kind of CJ Cherry affecting me, but I get the feeling that kind of space is more of a working class person's place. That if you have money and dignity, planets are the place to be. I could be wrong.
I think that's probably mostly true. There's the little islands and grottos and blue skies that kind of go the other way. But for the most part, yeah, it's a big infinite universe. There's plenty of opportunity and a lot of hard work to get there.
If you want it easy, and a planet is a much easier place than outer space, where you're never that far away from screaming death.
Well, I think you can link that very closely to naval tradition. The fisher that goes out on the small single-man boat, or the ones that go out in very small crews, you don't necessarily associate with a lot of wealth and power. Mm-hmm. The wealth and power that are out on the naval are the kings of their entire vessel, the captains. Uh-huh. They're the ones that run a 40-man crew, a 140-man crew, a battleship. I agree with you in the micro. But once you start getting large ships, especially some of the larger ships that they describe here, mm-hmm. you have to be a very strong leader, very powerful, whatever, to organize and to own or direct that type of thing. I think that falls way off of the everyman concept.
Sure. But you'd kind of put the soldier into this group as well, though, the part of the armed force, the mercenary type.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which brings us to number three on the hit parade, which is the hero or the warrior type. I think this one is different from the military man because they're a little more out there on their own. The defining ideas for the warrior hero is competitiveness, proving your worth, a certain level of arrogance. I can make a difference, or we can make a difference. This person is out to test their skill, to fight for what's right, and they're deeply uncomfortable with the idea of weakness as part of their kind of ongoing storyline. This is the Dragon Slayer, the team coach that leads everybody to victory, the person who's driven to competitiveness, and I think, hands down, this archetype is owned by Pulse.
Or IRPF. I think you make a good argument for that.
They play by the rules, but they do play.
While close to IRPF, I would say that the embodiment of this would really be the mercenary captain.
Is that more the pirate captain, or really every character in HSD is potentially mercenary? That's kind of the style of the game.
So the mercenary in and of themselves doesn't necessarily have to have a very strong personality. I think, again, I'm going to reference back the naval tradition I was talking about. If you look at your run-of-the-mill pirate, you know, they've got cutlass, they can run a ship. Maybe not the hero, the warrior archetype at that point. You look at the pirate captain, both historically and then in media, both at the time and now, the pirate captain is always a larger-than-life character. And they're almost always a larger-than-life character because you have to have that force of personality to run a bunch of lawless mercenaries and keep them pointed in the same direction long enough to bust up some heads and get a paycheck.
Because no one's born into pirate captaincy.
Right.
Or end up in command of the ship because, he has a really good degree. Or
later on, we'll encounter the leader type, which is more the head of the empire, the captain of the ship. So this is a little more about the fight rather than about wearing the hat.
This would be smaller scale and very lead from the front. Like, I think that is a defining warrior hero. It's leading from the front.
Yeah, and this is kind of a young person's perspective in most cases.
Well, a corporate slant on it might be the whistleblower type that's fighting against the kind of the darkness behind the corporations. This is the Progenda story in a nutshell, which is calling out the enemy, and the greatest dragon of all in this game is the corporate backbone. I think that would be a very HSD-style tragic character. You can't win against Marsco.
Or at the same time, that could be the young up-and-coming executive that is leaping up the corporate ladder.
Yeah. That's a good one, too. And you're continually testing yourself against the machine. There was a short story, Wines, that you've brought up a number of times, but I think not recently, which is Diamond Dogs. Is that the one where the guy transforms himself over the course of the story?
Yeah. They're going in that alien artifact that has these puzzles that get harder and harder and harder. So the people are putting more cybernetics in themselves so they can solve the puzzles. Whereas the ultimate secret is that this alien artifact eats cybernetics, because as it kills people, it harvests out the cybernetic parts and poops out their skeleton. The puzzles are so fascinating, people can't help but making their bodies better and faster and going back in to solve the next one.
That really fits a lot of the body horror that you get pretty regularly in HSD as well. That's one of the major horror elements in the game. The character that's continually refining their body into a paragon of beauty or skill would be, like, physically an embodiment of this particular trope. That would be, again, very pulse to me. Well, in a world that's got a strong element of physical crafting and toning and creating yourself, someone driven to be the best that is physically possible in this world could be a really frightening character.
Yeah. Or, like, species-wise, I mean, the positive take on this could be young female hyenas. Negative take could be any lion.
And so we come back.
or other species that have a reputation for kind of strength, like a wolverine or a bear. Or, flipping it around, the chihuahua that... He's going to be the best chihuahua that ever was. He's going to show everyone else.
There are no chihuahuas in HSD.
Oh.
Aren't there's dogs, right?
Absolutely, there's dogs.
Okay.
And you can be a chihuahua if you really want to.
When there's dogs and there's math, there's a remainder, and that's the chihuahua.
Well, it's also interesting that the hero does not necessarily... I mean, hero might actually be the wrong word, because that does come with certain connotations. The hero is usually successful because he is the hero, because the story makes him successful. As a character, either as a player or as an NPC, that archetype does not always mean success. So you do have the tragic hero, the fallen hero at the same time. So there is a lot more complexity to it than just the shining gold paladin that's going to kill the dragon because this is their story.
Looking at the archetype as the warrior type might be more educational and useful, because, again, this character is about striving, not necessarily about victory.
Eudaimonia?
We'll link to Eudaimonia in the show notes.
That's my big word for the week.
One of Wines' favorites, Eudaimonia, is the...
You're the one with a degree.
That's true. Is the asymptotic approach to virtue, greatness, and skill without ever actually achieving it. It's Greek. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to break this up a bit with one of my favorite NPCs, and I cannot remember his name. I can remember his inspiration, which is half Doctor Strange, half Dr. Byron Orpheus from Venture Brothers, the crazed mystic who pronounces everything by the fiery chains of Balathros. I love this character. I love the pompous mage, because he can do anything he needs to, but he's got this tragic weakness of his own ego and becomes totally ridiculous by it. So this character is so much fun to play as a game master, because as long as you can free improvise things to shout at your players, it's just a hoot. And he's a good kind of Gandalf background character to drop in if you need to rescue the party from themselves. But I love that necromancer, Dr. Orpheus. He is a real treasure and super fun to play. I've used him in at least two humorous superhero games at this point. I just keep coming back to him. I mean, I hate to say it's necessary. It's not really, because it takes away a lot of the player's agency to have your Gandalf in the game. But when you can water him down with total absurdity and this deep self-love of his own knowledge, I think it becomes a much more approachable character to have as a background type. Moving on down Pearson's hit parade, we have what she identifies as the caregiver. And this person's keyword is self-sacrifice. Martyrdom is kind of the dark side of it. They can't understand selfishness, and they're all about giving, putting the community above themselves. Not so good at the tough love concept, but like the good parent, the generous patron, someone who is at heart very selfless and very altruistic. The glitterati philanthropist is one type, but not one that's self-involved. Well, the entire Progenitus Corporation, I think, is founded on this look and feel, if not this actuality.
Well, they're certainly founded on the martyr complex.
They do like their martyrdom, and they are the front runners in the social justice war in this game. Always ready to lobby. One character I've enjoyed from the sci-fi world is Terry Gilliam's crusading repairman, who fights the bureaucracy by working around forms and regulations to go and repair someone's...
Oh, like from Brazil, right?
Yeah, Brazil. This person is willing to risk everything to put his skills into play and to help out the protagonist as well. I see him later, I think the movie The Gate and The Gate 2, of the occult adventuring electrician. This is a very narrow character role, but one that I love to see whenever it turns up. Furry favorite would be Princess Carolyn from BoJack Horseman.
Okay.
Is the agent who gives and gives and gives and gives and can't stop giving. You get a lot of those in Pulse, I'd imagine. The very few Pulse agents that can't stand on their own soapbox might need to prop someone up for them.
Okay, sure.
Overall, though, I found that this trope didn't lend itself very well to HSD. I'm not entirely certain why. It may be because the sort of the Shadowrun-esque mission assignment role just doesn't lend itself to the selfless character.
I think there's also a little bit of just the medium itself. It is structured as a role-playing game, a pen-and-paper game, or a round-the-table game. And generally, the type of relationships or inter-character connectivity isn't really built there. It is designed for four or five people to run their own characters through challenges, huh, type of thing. And that's kind of just... that is something that is understood and at the back in the subconsciousness throughout the entire process. One of the other ways that you would get a caregiver into a game that you would see often would be the parent, the brother, someone like that. Take a look at Firefly, the medic who had the psycho sister who he abandoned everything, got back from the government, and basically spends the rest of the story trying to care for her.
Yeah, that is an extended plot line written around a single individual, and those are very hard to pull off in an RPG.
Yeah, that is exactly it. It's very hard to pull off. It's very hard to get that kind of relationship between the PCs because someone is going to be at some sort of disadvantage that needs the care, and that's not generally a dynamic that you see between people that are sitting around a table.
Fundamentally, if you accept that HSD is not at heart a combat game, I think the need for a medic-focused character becomes a little bit less as well. And that's the other place where the party structure usually has the support character. That's the healer, the priest. Unless you're running a heavily combat-oriented game or a very military game, there's not really a place for that so much.
Counterpoint, as someone who often played clerics in D&D, I really would not say I ever took the caretaker role.
And I can also see... in this, the flip side of someone who's totally devoted and always does the right thing, it would mean having absolutely no sympathy with people that aren't like that. I mean, is Judge Dredd deep down that mad because people are just so impolite and don't do the right thing? Well, probably not, but...
Yeah, that's very Progenitus too, is getting your knickers in a total twist whenever somebody doesn't buy into the party line that the good of the many outweighs the needs of the person you're judging that particular point in time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking of like the border agent that really, how could you try to bring this into the country? How could you not know? Honestly,
this is Europa, people. We don't allow pet rabbits. I think the next one that Pearson floats is the Seeker. And this is much more PC, rather much more player character. The Seeker is someone who is on the lookout for the solution to the problem, is dedicated to the journey and avoiding conformity. They are kind of the scout, the trailblazer, the explorer type. They're looking for the next star, what's beyond the next horizon, and kind of this endless journey. The pilgrim, the wanderer, the journeyman. This is an endless road the person's on. And that is a pretty powerful PC emblem for me, I think, particularly in the Dungeons and Dragons style games where you're always looking to see what's down the hall, where you're trying to find the lost empire.
Or in a modern setting, that could be media.
The Han Solo. But the dark side again to the Seeker is that they would also be the eternal failure. Always seeking for something, but never achieving, never finding. Bouncing from one thing to another because they can never quite go the distance.
Yes, the 1940s plucky female reporter.
Okay, yeah, that is a character that's endlessly questing to get herself into terrible trouble.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the media you were pointing out again, too. This is where I'd put the TTI researcher myself. This is, for me, the seeker of knowledge in a kind of Lovecraftian mode is a really powerful version of this. The endless quest to find the thing that they are not supposed to find, to uncover the secrets, which, again, certain media types would kind of fall into that trap as well. Another idea would be the character that wants to return to Terra, either to explore ancient Earth or to unpack what's there now or reclaim the homeland in some way. And that's, I feel like that's one of the four or five standard narratives of a Ixxun Drakonis game is the return home.
Or it could be Progenitus, that's the healing the medical corporation, right?
Yeah, medical social justice.
Progenitus could be seeking out ills that need to be righted, things that need to be fixed.
Oh, the endless quest to prove that they're slightly more nobler than the rest of the corporations.
Or to do actual good, maybe some mix of the two.
Oh man, but that's not cynical. How can you have a non-cynical corporate motif? Things Man Was Not Meant to Know is a big one here for me again. The anti-whisper researcher would be a particularly doomed character in this world, trying to figure out how to avert the alien future apocalypse, endlessly looking for answers to questions the TTI is hiding.
So on the subject of seekers, this is a slight tangent, but TTI is often being thrown out as the investigatory, the research branch, but they seem to be very single focused on transcendent tech.
Yes, I think that's fair. It's in the name.
Absolutely. So where would you actually put the explorers in HSD?
Like the archaeologist types or the people that are going to like the far edges of the solar system, the Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto regions?
Yes and yes, or does that simply not exist? Exploring both external and internal. So some of the outer reaches of the solar system, but also, like you had said, Earth and Luna and some of the undiscovered places internally.
I think that it's been hinted at in canon. There's some people outside the inner core, but thus far the books have not taken us beyond Jupiter. But that certainly doesn't mean that people don't go beyond Jupiter. I think they must. Saturn is not that far away if you're willing to, you know, be with the same group of people for about a year and a half of travel time. Well, probably 6 weeks, 8 weeks or so. It seems like ASR might be able to hold on to that, the robotics group, because, I don't know, maybe I'm falling on 2001 and HAL the Talking Computer too heavily. But so far as scientific research goes, they feel like the most in line with that concept as a corporation. But that's also a place that the PC's little bitty corporation can go, because you don't know what resources are out there. Is there something phenomenal orbiting Saturn that will unlock the answers to the rest of the game's setting issues? I don't know. So far as named corps go, I put ASR at the head of this one. Everybody else is kind of inward focused, and TTI is deeply outward focused.
Well, but if ASR is obsessed with robotics, that's something you're making. You don't go out in the universe looking for new robotics parts. Maybe I'm just looking at it the wrong way.
Well, and all the corporations are focused on products. That's kind of how they define themselves. But so far as ideas go, the crusading scientist fits really well into ASR for me.
Okay.
And the kind of the long silent journey alone also feels more ASR than any other group. That corporation for me has a very sort of slate gray image and long silent nights in my head.
What was that 70s film we were talking about recently with the
Silent Running?
Silent Running, yes. The happy story of a man and his robots.
In Silent Running, it's one fellow drifting in the void, preserving a little sort of arc of domed forest in the middle of space. Maybe Earth will be inhabitable someday, maybe not. But again, it's very one person alone drifting in space. And you said it was the inspiration for Mystery Science Theater, right?
No. Well, okay, I'm sorry, yes. Yeah, Joel Hodgson took his inspiration for that. But also, George Lucas saw that film and then asked for permission to copy the robots for it for his new film, Star Wars. And that's where R2-D2 came from. R2-D2 is a copy of one of those little robots from Silent Running.
One more and then a pause. We have the lover character archetype, which it's worth pointing out, is not necessarily Pepe Le Pew. This is also the person that is dedicated to the search for pleasure, the bon vivant, the celebration, the party goer. So this is the person that's in love with the world as much as themselves, as much as this potential significant other they'll ever actually catch. They are the fun-going character. This character plays out in all sorts of people in the luxury literati space.
Or even outside of that. So the glitterati will definitely hold a certain lock on the lover, although I would argue there generally be some of the secondary generations, the ones that don't necessarily earn their place but are born into it. But you'll get that at a lot of different socioeconomic strata as well. The crazy nightclub, the crazy chemical crowd, follow the music, follow the love. You'll hit a lot of the type of things that aren't quite lover, just partner intimate, which is what you have at the top of the... That spins off into a different direction. The Burning Man type, the counterculture very much, would be filled with the lover archetype. The people that just... Screw commercialism. I'm going to go live in a desert and be one with myself and the universe also would fall under archetype type.
Yeah, the summary for this one is follow your bliss. It's seek what makes you happy and joyful. And I think that's a really good place to focus their story.
And if that's sex, drugs, and techno rock and roll, then you go be yourself, man.
The character I'd like to see here, rather than in the irritating android mode, would be the cog who wants to find themselves. I think one of the ideas that maybe is not well placed in this species is the search for sensation, is the search for being a more real creature. I don't know if the cogs are established as being totally their own race at this point or not, or if they're still trying to explore some ideas of emotion and a more organic reality. But you could play that one here as the seeker for life.
I think they are pretty well defined as solidly their own race and pretty solidly static. Development was not individually, but just as a race. But yes, there's definitely plenty of room to play up the, but I want to be a real boy angle, or the search for differences between the vector and the cog.
Yeah. The character I could see myself playing, because I really like time bombs, would be a cosmetic surgeon, a luxury surgery specialist who is trying to craft the person that he dreams of.
I can see this going so horribly, horribly wrong.
Yes.
Once they get their hands on Vitae.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
that story you were asking about earlier, the Diamond Dog story, one of the characters in it was an expert roboticist who was along to help this party who was exploring this artifact out. And once things started getting really hard, they realized we need some serious cybernetic augmentation. So this guy happily rolls up his sleeves and he does this amazing job at them, builds them these amazing cyber bodies, puts all of their, a lot of their old biological bodies kind of in vats for later to put them back into when they're done. Mm-hmm. But they go in, they do a whole bunch of stuff, they come back, and he's now killed himself, leaving a note saying, I could not bear myself to take apart those beautiful bodies I've put you in. Sorry. This was the cap of my existence, building these beautiful cybernetic bodies. Please enjoy them. Now, I'm thinking, again, just in terms of kind of more oddball interpretations of this, the person that really loves bureaucracy, that really loves the feel of a folder which has been sorted and all the numbers are in place, he's willing to go out in the universe, take charge of a bunch of crazy people that don't know how to file expense reports, and have that great feeling of putting everything in order. That'd be a very, very modern industrial take on the lover.
Order, but not for desire for order, but because of the visceral feel of a job well done.
Yeah. I totally buy this.
Yeah, well, they could be happy with a small triumph as well as a large-scale one. That'd be good.
Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine doing taxes for a party of adventurers? You'd have to be masochistic or just love it for its own sake.
There is a certain satisfaction in a place for everything and everything in its place. And if you...
that fell out of its place.
And if you expand that as an obsession, that I could see that character.
Yeah, that'd be fun. He should have a New York accent. I'm going to need a lot of schmear. In reading the series Game of Thrones, as I was going through it, like the character Jamie, who's this, he's full of himself. He's a rich white boy. He has everything. He's cool, but he's a schmuck. He's not a nice guy.
It sounds like the good beginning of a hero journey.
And then George Martin takes it. He puts him in harm's way, puts him alongside one of my favorite characters, Brienne, who's the perfectly obsessed knight. She wants to be the perfect knight. Whereas Jamie, of course, he's the corrupt. He's a very bad example. He's a bad knight. He's a bad man.
Martin draws us some very bold markers.
He really does. And he starts telling the story, and I realize a few books in, my God, I'm starting to sympathize with this character. This character is starting to learn. I'm starting to have a little bit of respect for him. And I'm like, wow, that's really impressive, because I've spent several books just loathing this guy, and I'm starting to have a grudging respect for him. That's good for you, Mr. Martin.
And then he dies. Spoilers.
Oh, God.
Well, yeah, he hasn't, has he?
Everybody dies. The bean in the cup.
As of Dance of Dragons, he's still alive.
I have not read
the... Oh, I see. You're just riffing.
I have not watched the show. I have not read the books that far. So,
well, this is kind of the textbook idea of the hero's journey, is the character that starts heavily burdened by their flaws and then refines them, grows from them, and they're still a part of him at the end of it, but he can become something stronger. Not necessarily by divesting himself of all of his flaws, but by realizing they're the dark side of something stronger.
Maybe losing a few body parts on the way.
Yeah, who needed that? I mean, it really wasn't important.
But that's also a recurring theme to increase impact, is you have the character that you don't necessarily like. They have their flaws. You start warming up to them. You start forming a connection with them. You start grudgingly liking them, and then they die horribly.
Ashtar, were you hurt by George Martin?
I refuse to answer that question.
Well, it can sneak up on you, because when you see a character that's just out of the gate, it's like, oh, that's a nice guy. It's like, okay, I'm being played to like this person. And it's like, okay, I'll accept that. But when it sneaks up on you again, when you do it over time, that's...
You let your guard down.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't ready for that.
I feel like this is kind of a hard place for a player character to begin, because PCs want to leap full-blown out of the head of Zeus, and they don't want to start flawed. If you're doing a hero's journey type thing, you have to start smaller. You have to start as the orphan before you become Superman. You have to start on the dust farm on Tatooine before you become a Jedi. This is the begin low and high sort of arc, and PCs tend to start pretty potently, or they want to. They want to be that person on day one.
As a game master, I have pitched several ideas of starting and staying at level one for a while, but no one ever wants to play those games. The cringes that I saw just saying that answers that perfectly.
Well, in HSD, we haven't really been talking about, man, I just can't wait till I get my power armor suit or my surgery and stuff like that.
I think we've all said, man, I can't wait till I get my second tail.
I don't know. I don't feel like we've had that drive to this other thing that we just really want or need, which might be a problem of motivation, because we're supposed to want to spend the money to do these things.
Not having levels really helps with that. You do not have a goal. You do not have that incremental advancement towards the goal. You don't have that schedule that you're feeling on.
You just have a reputation that you've all been walking on and smudging and squishing flat and getting all dirty. And
a ledger that just keeps getting more and more into the red.
Maybe we should leave.
I thought it started out that color anyway. Just needs to stay there. Let's see, moving on towards number 7, that is the Destroyer. Now, I think the Destroyer is kind of a messy, dirty word. And it occurs to me that my current favorite comic book, The Wicked and Divine, the main character has taken on the mantle of the Destroyer. This is the character that is responsible for the dramatic change. This is the troubleshooter that will happily destroy the old system to rebuild the new one. The Rebel Alliance character that is overthrowing the government. The massive game changer that wants to unleash something that will totally destroy the current transportation industry and replace it with something that's under his control. Not necessarily destruction, but powerful transformation without a lot of concern for who gets harmed in the process. The fire that lets the forest grow again. By their nature, destroyers are not very good at sympathy or empathy. They are all about the transformation and the change and don't get in their way.
or the series I've been reading, rereading recently by P.C. Hodgel, the Kensereth series about Jamie, who is, she's an incarnation of the destroyer act aspect of the deity. She's a nice person. She just keeps destroying things. And it's said of the characters, like, I expect to come back with the entire Riverlands in flame and you standing in the middle apologizing for it.
Yeah.
I mean, destroying things doesn't necessarily mean, well, the author spins that is that this character just sees wrong, doesn't have a notion of how to build a right, but does know how to get rid of the wrong. And I think player characters can relate to that. It's an unusual player character that steps in and says, well, this society could be better. Let's improve it. Rather, they'll step in and say, look, this person is causing a lot of problems, or this thing is causing a lot of harm. Let's destroy it and then move on.
At the same time, the destroyer aspect does not necessarily have to be intentional. It can also be part of just who they are. To take a couple of examples, the little girl at the end of the HSD story that has the transcendent weird shadows. Now, initially, she's very innocent. She's been pulled out of her safe place. She's going somewhere. But the book kind of sets her up as she is going to change society just by being who she is. Mm-hmm. Wherever she goes, corporations are going to be left in chaos in her wake, chasing after her, trying to figure out what's going on, whatever. She is a destroyer.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the John Constantine character who tries to make good, but just leaves a path of devastation in his wake that he simply cannot control. I think in the HSD universe, the most powerful symbol of this character type is the shadow CEO. Every corporation has the head, the chief executive officer, but right behind him, lurking in the darkness, is the shadow CEO. No one knows who that person is, and they have one job, which is to put down the CEO when he gets out of hand. And I think that's a really concrete example of the destroyer at their darkest.
Or you can take the destroyer at some of their lightest and look at Progenitus. Progenitus was born upon the destroyer. They went in, they found something that was unexpected, and they
mass-marketed it.
overthrew that part of the corporate structure and brought about change.
Oh, I was thinking DDI, not Progenitus. Yes, them. They are the thing that grew out of the fire in the forest.
Mm-hmm. Or investigative journalists that they seek things out in order to expose them. They don't fix it. They make it vulnerable. They destroy people in a social sense or in a political sense.
The modern trope that plays out really well here is the disruptive technology developer. It's huge in the startup electronics period that we're in right now.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I could see that. You know, doing nice things like, let's give people pills, let them live forever. Oops. Didn't think that one through.
The entire corporation of Spyglass, all of them. The destroyer's kind of diametric opposite is the creator type. Quintessential one is the artist and the dreamer. This is the person that builds cities in the clouds, that creates without really regard for where they're going to be tomorrow. They live for making and developing and building and writing and synthesizing, and aren't really that good at the business side of things afterwards. Tend to be kind of disconnected from the real world.
As well, implicit with that, it does need to stand in contrast with the destroyer. What they are doing is they are adding to the culture or society. They're not necessarily changing or replacing.
They aren't seeking to overturn anything. That's more of a sort of idyllic almost existence. This is like the bard that plays the lute or something. It's not about destroying the world and building an altar for themselves. It's about the act of creation and the joy of that.
They do seem to kind of shade into each other, at least for me.
Well, and you do have to be fairly careful which way you play it. You can have the bard that tells the story, or you can have the bard that lives in the woods and is actively trying to overthrow the Sheriff of Nottingham. Mm-hmm. Both are bards, but they're two very distinct ways to approach.
That's right. Yeah, like in the Disney Robin Hood, the song making fun of the corrupt politician. That's a destructive. I mean, they created the song, but it's a destructive act.
And that's sort of the trickster trope that I think we reach for later on. To me, it seems like this trope is one that HSD has trouble with as a game. It's a very consumer-driven world. Mechanically, there just aren't the rules for this sort of character. I think that the society is very much about receiving rather than giving. It may be this makes a great place for player characters to stand then, because they are so much above the plebs that they can create art. No one else does. But I think it's a challenged archetype in this game.
I would say that's a challenge to put a PC into, but I think there are plenty of examples within HSD. There's practically an entire race built around them, the Kogsune. When you take a look at the executive that is just driving forth and creating their vision, the researcher that lives on their little space station and spends the next 10 years of their life developing the next whatever widget that they're working on, the creator, the innovator, the inventor side has a large place in HSD. I just don't think it's a very interesting one for the stories or the PCs that are often told.
I guess it's kind of self-involved. I mean, I'm imagining, again, kind of comedically, the person that's like, you know, I don't care what adventure we go on. I'm good for it as long as I get to spray paint graffiti wherever we go.
Picking up again from the last episode where we talked about the idea of creation as a form of counterculture, the hippie commune society dropout and rebel kind of fits in this one as well, because they are creating culture in a way that's not designed to transform, but designed to kind of celebrate. In D&D, you might find the druid in the woods. I think that this is kind of the role for that character, is someone who breaks away from society and lives the artisan life. Doing that is genuinely creative in a way that is not particularly going to change the world.
Well, I could see like a character coming from a matriarchal society might go out into the world and fight patriarchy wherever they see it. Or they might promote, hey, look what women can do for you. Look what women are good at. That would be the kind of creation and destruction ways of expressing the same idea.
Or to expand on my earlier example, within the Kogsune, the executive that created and released them upon the world would not fall under a creator level here. That there was too many things that went wrong. There were too many other motives that were floating around. But the Kogsune themselves, quite happy to go out to their distant space stations and just build whatever the heck they've been building for the last however many years, maybe touch base with society every now and then, and then disappear right back into their research communes. I think they're probably the closest example HSD has to pure creators.
Yeah, and the fact that they kind of walk lightly on the world helps with that too. They don't leave destruction in their wakes. They are very task-focused. They narrowcast on a mission, kind of like Men in Black almost, for the ASR Corporation. They appear, they do a thing, and they move on. For our listeners who aren't totally familiar with this book or the supplement, the Kogsunes are, I think, largely an NPC race, or a race that a campaign would be kind of crafted around. They're addicted to work, highly modular, semi-robot fox things with detachable limbs and profoundly powerful deep technology that's well beyond the ken of standard vector kind. Very Men in Black type characters. They're not really meant to integrate with normal society, and the tools they have at their disposal are terrifying.
I could see a character, someone that wanted to bring order places to a character that, if your campaign takes you like kind of wild places, you know, you might bring down bad guys or bad forces, but I could see certain characters that say, I want to try to help them craft a new government. I want to help them put together new medical services, stuff like that.
I think this kind of flows into the next big archetype, which is the ruler type. And this is the person whose primary value is harmony, balance, order, efficiency, organization, and kind of operates out of a fear of chaos. Now, this isn't constructive, this necessarily. This might be about pure control, which seems less benevolent than where you were going with this kind of gentle creator mindset. This is the person who creates order out of chaos, who builds systems that perhaps are too complex and may break down, but their story is ultimately one of trying to carve stability out of an insane and variable world.
Or party.
Or party, yes. That is the doomed cat herder, and that is a very sad person to play. Please trust me on this.
But a critical aspect of the ruler is that they are not an isolationist. The man alone on his rock is not a ruler of much of anything at all. You need a society to have a ruler, to be a ruler, to be the first among equals. For all eyes to turn upon you to lead, there must be other eyes. So I think that's pretty critical that you can't really leave out of the ruler archetype.
A great place to set a bureaucracy-focused game, which could have some real tension and terror, would be on Europa. Europa is a moon colony that's a few thousand feet above untold cosmic horrors. B is dome cities sitting in ice where the smallest crack can spell doom for thousands of people. That is a place where bureaucracy becomes a like teeth gritting war against loss and chaos, and a really, I think, quote, fun, unquote, environment to set some order focused characters. The threat of system failure would be so great that a couple of people with monkey wrench type tendencies could have a great time.
Members of social species. I mean, one of the ideas of the canid hierarchy is this: the always pushing for status. One can easily go that way as a lion or a dog or a hyena, always seeking a place where, hold on, there's a place here where I could try to prove that I'm better than this person.
It seems like HSD has a love-hate relationship with species stereotypes, which I think is unfortunate because as a game that's got at least one foot in the furry fandom pretty heavily, we like playing with species stereotype. I think it's somewhat unfortunate they don't play up the dog hierarchy thing as much as you get in Iron Claw or World Tree or some of the other more pro-animal furry games.
Yeah. Well, it's worth thinking about. It means that social animals, that is an interesting thing. Non-social animals, that's also very interesting in a totally different direction. It doesn't have to define your character. Just because you play a dog or a wolf doesn't mean you have to be always worrying about who's sniffing whose butt. But you can go that way.
No, it definitely leaves it open. HSD goes to great pains to put it very upfront that these are all humans, and the culture break that occurred means that those stereotypes were all left behind. And then it promptly goes in to explain the different races that or the different species and sets up all the stereotypes of what they think of the other species. Mm-hmm. So you have both sides there, and then it gives you the option to play both sides.
Yeah. And is this a game that humans play? Hell yeah.
The doomed captain or the leader of a failing colony, I think, is a fun one here as well. Just that sense of inevitable destruction of everything. Got to push it back for as long as I possibly can. That character turns up again and again in a lot of the modern sci-fi series. I love him. Social media specialist. That one I'd like to put here as well. Someone who's got the web of communication going on and is sitting right in the middle of it trying to push their brand. Using the mass culture society as their tapestry to play out their messages.
Communications officer.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't already have a hierarchy, being the person in charge of communications can give you a lot of power, a lot of social power.
Some good criminal archetypes can fit here as well. A small-time gang leader on Phobos, or someone trying to hack out a living in a hot zone between two corporations, really kind of monopolizing a transition time and a transition space.
I also think it's interesting to kind of contrast the ruler against the warrior that we had discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. While the warrior can be a leader, they are very much a lead from the front type.
Yeah, they're testing themselves, whereas I think the ruler tests everybody around them.
Right. Whereas the ruler is more of the, not lead from the shadows, but lead from above and send others to exert will type thing. Whereas the warrior would be wading right into the thick of it. The ruler has people for that.
Yeah, the ruler is showing off, kind of saying it comes down to my social skills. The warrior is, it comes down to my, it could be combat skills, could be my technical skills, something other than the interpersonal skills.
Or not even that. The ruler could just be power. I mean, I don't have to break his knees. Timmy over here does that. Timmy, break his knees. That's ruler. Whereas that is not what a warrior would approach the same situation.
So I don't remember if we have any Star Trek buffs at the table today or not, but Catherine Janeway has been my questionable captain in the Star Trek continuity. I don't know if I like her or have a deep distrust of her, because while Kirk has the, I guess, very masculine role of the frontline warrior captain, Janeway is the most people-focused and collaborative of the captains of Star Trek, and it seems like she's continually putting everything to a vote rather than taking direct action. Kind of a pillar around which plot spins rather than someone that really revs the engine herself. And Janeway as leader is someone that brings out other people's strengths, and that's an interesting role. It's someone that maybe isn't dynamic in a time of combat, but over the course of an ensemble series, which is what most RPGs are, may have some real strength as a character type. So wrapping up Pearson's list of major archetypes with some of the most idiosyncratic, solitary, and kind of self-focused roles, we'll begin with the Magician. I have a hard time telling how the Magician and the Destroyer are different. They're both major agents of transformation and change. The Magician is a manipulator more than the Destroyer is the person at the center of the web that pulls strings, that focuses on how things are related, but is still very much a change character. If you hold the Magician card of the tarot, you see someone who is juggling forces, not necessarily throwing the switch.
I think one of the major differences between the two is you will never have an unintentional Magician. You can have an unintentional Destroyer. You can have an inherent Destroyer. But a Magician, everything about that has got to be calculated, intentional. They are the puppet master.
What would you call that nice fellow that decided that vectorizing an exonymph was a good idea? For those of you that haven't read the books, there is a fun little chapter they're called exonymphs. They are what we've gone back and forth on calling the brain bugs. They were a created race that turned into a kind of invasion of the body snatchers type monster over time.
If I remember, he had a certain guardianship overtone to it, in which case I would almost put him into caregiver. That this was his life's work, this was his creation, and he was bringing them to their final evolution the way that they should have been. Now, I might be remembering that wrong, but that's an interesting spin on it.
Well, no, and you can spin the story in a bunch of different ways. That's an interesting take as this character as the as a creator, as the father or mother of a race. Sure, you could totally take that, and then his race ate him. But the beginning of his story, what might have been an act of generosity.
See, and one of the things that I do not remember from the story is any sort of motive coming in. He wasn't trying to create them to sell them. He wasn't trying to create them as to control them. It was either pure scientific curiosity, can I do this? Or it was a little bit more of a benevolence, if I remember right.
I'll definitely take that. It wasn't necessarily intentional to create culture of Jack the Ripper types. But we've also kind of gone back and forth on whether you are intentionally Destroyer or not. The intentionality hasn't necessarily mattered in the conversations we've been having tonight.
I believe that was Dr. Gaelic San.
Gaelic San, yeah. I've dropped his name a few times now.
And the motivation that was dropped in the book itself was that he was trying to create a better communication route with the bugs to better direct them to create colonies.
That does kind of rule out the Destroyer thing, because it wasn't an attempt to transform or revolutionize society. It was an attempt to make a better world.
Yeah, although when you allow for accidental Destroyers as being part of the archetype, that makes it harder to draw clean lines.
Even vectorizing the exonymphs didn't really bring about a massive or even a minor societal change. They're still very much in the shadows in the background. He might be a future Destroyer, but at the moment, innocence isn't quite right, but he was a tech who did not think through the consequences of his actions.
You might say it's kind of author's intent. I mean, you can read the same character in different ways, but if you, as the person creating the character, say, well, the most interesting thing I find about the character is that he changes things, okay, then he's a wizard. Now, other people might interpret what he does in different ways, but to you, that's what he is. Maybe that's it.
Well, in the beginning of the wizard's story is the Sorcerer's Apprentice animating the broomsticks and creating their own foil. The end of the story is the powerful figure that actually can plan out what he's doing. And there's a lot of stages in between there of not necessarily being able to control all the forces they unleash.
See, and in that note, I would assert that the Destroyer is kind of furthering the pursuit of chaos and change, the magician is actually furthering the pursuit of order, because his power comes from being the power behind the ruler, the power behind the throne, but he wants a certain amount of order because that's what he can control. Pure chaos? How are you going to control that? You wait for it to pass and then you reassert whatever power you have.
This is a place, another place I'd put the Pulse social media specialist, someone that really focuses on sending messages out that can theoretically change society, not necessarily always in the way that he or she hopes for or plans to.
Tries to control and direct the discussion, the society, the culture of the time.
It's like the guy that does the social media column or the technology column.
Right. But within that example, if the social media guy sets off a firestorm or a meme that he just can't control that just explodes and starts ruining people, he's no longer the magician. He's no longer in control of this.
Another character I could see strongly falling into the oops, what did I unleash category is the AI specialist who creates a self-aware program. I think that's been played once or twice in popular media, you know, once or twice.
Once or twice.
But not necessarily in HSD. That was a very measured and intentional decision that the corporation stood behind and said, no, this is what we did. This is what we intended to do. And you're just going to have to live with it.
Yeah. HSD never goes the Skynet route, as far as I can tell. It's dipping its toes in there with TTI. But I think that creating the game's first truly self-aware AI that rampages free is definitely something that's left to the player character's devices. By the way, thank you for giving me the AI toolkit in our Sunday campaigns, Ashtar. I appreciate that.
As a longtime sci-fi reader, thank you to the creator so much for leaving out that tired thing, trope of the AI going wild, etc. And if players want to do that, if you find that interesting, sure, go for it. Or if individual GMs do. This idea has been being done in movies since the 1920s. Let's move on.
I think it's played a little bit in DDI. They have the ships that occasionally lose their minds, but that's more like an animal barely under control.
Yeah, that's fine. People lose their minds. As long as it's not destroying the whole world.
To be fair, that is also kind of the origin story. And I don't want to touch too heavily on that, but it kind of is. And then after that reset, everything else comes around, and I guess you could say the second time around, everything was done right.
Uh-huh. Oh, that origin story, right. Okay, we're on Hydra there.
Yes.
A note for our players at home that haven't read the book yet. In the backstory of Ixun Draconis, Earth was destroyed in a nuclear holocaust that was partially triggered by a rogue AI. There's a lot of hazy in that, and I think that's left as an exercise to the Game Masters what that actually means, but that is a kernel in the books.
To be fair, it was never defined as an AI. It was simply kind of malware that went above and beyond what it was expected, and then everything got hazy, and it doesn't get defined any further.
That's true. We don't actually know what kind of intervention took place there, and it might not have been a computer program at all. Taking on to a more peaceful character, we have the Sage. The Sage is another kind of investigator type. They're skeptical, curious, analytical, sometimes kind of judgy, looking for the truth. Their keywords are understanding. They fear falsehood and lies and deception and illusion. They are the cynics. They are the truth seekers. And they are the experts in the game.
That's interesting that's very much almost a Western take on that. I would say this also very firmly sits the Sage as mystic of maybe not so connected with the world, the monk, the wise man who doesn't really care for the day-to-day anymore because they're focused on higher things.
Yeah, someone who's attained a level of clarity in their life, of understanding, and maybe they want to market that, or maybe they want to remove themselves from the world because of it. I would consider putting middle management here, not so much in the sense of understanding, but in the more D&D sense of the word sage, where you have a character who is a destination point because of their knowledge and understanding, or would like to be so. Someone that's got a vast well of institutional knowledge that they can bring to the table is a useful PC, but also a powerful tool as a background character.
A resource.
Yeah, totally. The IRPF rules lawyer might be a fun character here too. One of the inner ring police forces challenges is that laws change constantly such that their own corporation can't really agree on them because they have to shift from rule set to rule set to rule set as they journey across the solar system. So someone who is deeply focused on the way rule and law actually works could have some real power in this universe.
I'm struggling to think of a really fun, creative interpretation of the sage. It's just not jumping to mind.
The truth is out there.
Well, it's wacky.
Well, I can't remember his name all of a sudden. The X-Files male lead.
Part of the problem with the sage is that the sage doesn't necessarily have much of an action or much of a seeking component to it.
Yeah,
the sage really has already reached their destination to a certain amount, or that the next step of their journey is internal.
That's reasonable. They're a character that's developing, kind of like the wizard does, or the magician. There's someone who is freeing themselves from a fear of objectivity and falseness, and that is a very internal journey.
It's kind of like, is it automatically passive? What is an active sage that is not something else?
An analyst type, certain troubleshooters, maybe.
Someone who wanders from person to person telling them what they need to hear.
Well, any...
oh, a jerk.
This might be a little bit of a stretch, but a more active sage might be someone who has the answer, knows the answer, but was, I don't know, pushed out of the corporation. The corporation is now going down a bad path, and the sage is on their journey to reassert control or to turn them from that path and turn them back towards non-destructive. You could spend several sages, right or wrong, around TTI that think that pursuing this transcendent technology is going to collapse the dimension into horribleness and TTI must be stopped. I could see that character.
I just finished reading one of the issues of the Sandman comic series towards the end, where we meet the Emperor's advisor who's been cast into exile, and maybe someday he'll go back. But for now, his knowledge was invaluable for years and years, but now it's become a liability and he's lost in the desert trying to find a new home. And his journey is because what he knows is potentially harmful or revelatory. It's interesting that this character seems to be more about place than journey, though. Like,
what's the character? Cassandra? The seer character who sees things, but it never helps?
Yeah, no one wants to believe her. Yeah, that's a good one, and a very cursed character as well.
I thought of a modern active interpretation expressed by the one-frame cartoon. Not now, honey. Someone on the internet is wrong.
I mean, my favorite illustration of the sage would probably have to be back to the Matrix. Both the architect and the prophet are going to be sage characters. But in both cases, both of them are very stationary. They're NPCs. They are a destination. You go to them to meet them, to get a question answered, and then you move on with your hero journey.
Well, the whistleblower type might work here because that's someone whose deep well of knowledge has become a weapon. And that's a fairly active agent.
Okay, and I was gonna ask, you know, well, like, what's the coolest sage character I can think of? And I immediately thought, no, Sherlock Holmes.
True, that is a person. Fun,
I mean, he does a lot of different things. There are aspects to what he does, but first and foremost is that he is a sage.
And he fits kind of the low-level beginning of the story because he's fiercely judgmental and pedantic and a bit of a jerk.
yeah.
But yeah, an analytical character, that's true. He is one of the models for this role, really.
And that doesn't stop him from getting out there and being active.
And I think that is a wonderful counter to the Fox Mulder that you were talking about earlier, who is seeking the truth.
But doesn't have it. Good point.
Sherlock Holmes has the truth. He merely needs to look at something to ascertain the truth.
He has to follow through. Yeah, he has to figure out what the problem is.
Right.
So he can apply his answers.
So I guess we can wrap up the archetype with the fool or the jester who in the tarot is kind of a return to innocence.
It's the circle of life. And look, back to lions.
Whoops, dropped one.
So the jester is a trickster character. His main foil is the ruler, is the fear of oppression and the fear of stagnation. He lives for the moment. He's irresponsible, self-indulgent, but also very intelligent and perceptive. He likes to live by his wits. He's a satire artist, willing to poke needles into the ruler's backside, what have you.
So, immediate question. What makes the jester different from the lover?
I think the lover can be content. I'm not sure the fool ever can. But both of them are fairly hedonistic roles.
Yeah, whereas the jester, you need someone else. I mean, a gourmand could be a lover, an example of that. But a jester, you need someone or something to mess with.
Yeah, they're kind of an opposing figure. They spring up when stagnation and order is too big of a force, which really in some ways defines the agency setting if you take it in a dystopian route.
Or even if not, people need to be messed with.
That's true.
And that's a big media thing, is the notion that let's stir stuff up. You know, things should not just be left the way they are.
I think anybody that's in the tinfoil hat wearing off the grid, slightly paranoid mode could fill this role really well in HSD, because the effort it would take to get away from the corporate overlord's oversight would be almost a character defining belief system on its own.
Well, the thing of the phrase, you know, this guy looks too clean. We need to look into him. it can be kind of being jaded or cynical, is to say that there's a flip side to everything and we need to be aware of it. It may not be the most important thing, but
in some ways this archetype seems almost too solitary, too contrary to really exist well in a highly social setting. I think the challenge is for playing someone that's that kind of self-centered is not quite the right word I'm looking for. But in certain ways, this is like the bright side of the stone cold killer Wolverine archetype.
I think another challenge to it is, how do you play the truth teller in the information age? If every truth is already out on the net somewhere, along with 12 or 13 other variations, what novelty is there in yelling the truth on the street?
David Icke has been saying the same thing for over 40 years and never stops pointing out there are lizard monsters behind the next major corporate figure. I think the crusading blogger might fit this role pretty well.
Do you think the jester implies solitariness? Can you have a group jester or a corporation of jester?
I think to me it's a social thing. It's not a solitary. I mean, it could be a solitary thing, but I think that more intrinsically it's social.
Oh, I don't mean like excluded from society. I mean singular. Like, is there only one Joker on the stage at any given time, or can you have a corporation of jokers?
I hope there's only one of them, because those are so awful. Speaking as like one of these standard order people in the room, this is the person whose head I want to stave in with a poker. I'm glad there's only one of them.
Whereas, I think in your game, so many people have this smartass, and myself included, just look at this. I was like, how could this go wrong? This would be pretty funny if it did. And we're all, so many of us are okay with that.
There's a reason I generally give you rope. And not above board contracts.
Yeah, we don't need instructions on the rope. We know how to misuse it.
It would be nice if it was longer, because I'm having a hard time hanging myself with this 2-foot length.
It's because you're short.
I think this is a great PC thing, because it's a kinder, gentler destroyer. And honestly, PCs tend to be kind of sarcastic.
Or it also can be dialed back.
Yeah.
And one of the problems with the destroyer, especially the implicit destroyer, is that you cannot dial that back. You bring about chaos simply by existing. Or the intentional destroyer, sometimes you just can't help it. The guard captain looked at me funny. I'm attacking him with my great sword.
Right. And that's in the real world, being the person who'll mouth back to the king, that's tough. In the D&D world, being the person who'll mouth back to the king, it takes discipline not to, because, you know, the players... Deep down, they're trying to take it seriously. But, you know, who cares?
And most of them.
Most of them. And so it's a very edgy thing, which is really, really, it's kind of easy. I'm going to walk up to that guy and hit the A button repeatedly.
In all of these archetypes, I tried to link it back to something that was uniquely HSD. And I think the trickster was the only one where I was totally stumped. I think because the character is pretty darn timeless, or at the very least, his modern incarnations kind of go forward 700 years without any real trick or trouble. He doesn't change much in certain ways over the centuries.
Well, the way I see it, HSD has a lot of different ideas of what is humanity or what could humanity be. And these different ideas don't agree with each other. And, you know, they'll be like, you know, yeah, okay, yeah, you've got that thing, you've got the lion thing going on, as I love to harp on. It's like, you know, well, the hyenas are kind of the counterexample to the other felids. They are the kind of the jester species to the other ones. Likewise, in the back of my head, foxes are always just like, oh, wolves. Oh, you think things make sense. You've got an order. This looks like fun.
I think the weasels are the predefined trickster race in HSD for the most part.
Muslims
in general are such spazzes in the color text that that's their role.
Are the bears kind of outside? I mean, not necessarily tricksters.
No, the bears are definitely outsiders, and I think they're really neat, but they're outsiders. They're drifters without an identity. So for me, they're tied to the everyman type character, or maybe the creator. They're lost and looking for a home and a background. I think Pearson would say they were orphans more than anything else, the orphan everyman role.
I would bet them more orphan or seeker.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. They're the outsider looking for an inn or someone doomed never to find a home.
What's there's like in episodic stuff, like TV stuff, or
picaresque.
There's the trope of the wandering main character, or like Doctor Who is an example, who goes different places. And the main character tends to be kind of basic everyman who goes places where there's very, very strange things. And he kind of brings his or her just kind of common perspective to it and says, hey, look, y'all have this problem, which could be expressed in a I fix things where I go, or like Doctor Who is kind of a trickster. He goes and he kind of pokes fun at people. He kind of messes with people, says, look, this isn't so great. Hey, but he has a very pleasant attitude about it.
Sometimes I think that it depends on what doctor you're at, because
that's true.
In my experience, some doctors and most player character parties leave destruction in their wake. Oh, that town's burning. You must have been there.
I guess I'm thinking of like the Tom Baker Doctor Who.
Yeah, he was a benevolent trickster.
Yeah. Waltzes into a situation and says, this is a silly situation. Have some candies. Have some jelly babies.
There comes a time in each man's life when he can't even believe his own eyes.
Well, after your description, I don't think I'd want to see it either.
Yeah, on that sage bit of commentary, I'd like to ask the hosts what they think is awesome this week. Perhaps some little story or new product or movie you've found particularly fascinating this time around.
I was mentioning to you earlier, I was reading that one of the big Japanese car manufacturers, I think Honda, is working on having a car that has more of a personality. And one of the ways that they're exploring to do that is to give it a face. They'll kind of look at you on the dashboard, which they're doing. It's a very, very simple cartoon face.
Didn't Douglas Adams do this already?
He definitely thought of it, but it can move to different displays at different parts of the car. It can move to the headlight covers, which will have little displays on them. So, for example, it can communicate or have little text messages to appear to acknowledge or greet pedestrians that are walking in front of it.
Oh, my gosh.
It sounds really adorable, and I'm really looking forward to this.
Very much linked into that, some of the more luxury car makers that have been experimenting with the same things have been working on some of the internals, and they're really starting to put together, working towards a prototype holographic system internally so that you could kind of project just a floating keyboard. Uh-huh. But they're linking that with, I forget exactly what it's called, but it's kind of like what lasers do for light. This does for sound.
It's like,
so you don't really hear it.
Stuff.
But when your fingers touch where the hologram is, you get a little feedback. You get a little touch feedback just in the middle of air. So you can actually feel the hologram and control things that way.
Oh, this isn't a thing. Seriously, this is a thing?
Yes. This is a thing.
Yes, it's real.
I'm not ready for this.
This is very rapidly approaching prototyping.
This future is too soon for me.
Because, of course, I'm thinking of it with these awesome cars that have personalities is, what about giving it a punk personality? Are we going to get tickets because our cars are too rude? when it starts telling pedestrians, you know, hurry it up, old lady.
Well, that depends on how easy it is to hack and reprogram the personality AI.
Yeah, I want a Rainbow Dash module in mine.
Yeah. The electric car I have, the Leaf, has a thing where it'll make a noise, kind of a whooshing noise, if a pedestrian is in front of it, because electric cars are quiet. It's just to let people know. And a constant question is, can we hack in and replace that with the Jetsons car noise? But apparently they've thought of that. They've made it very, very hard to do, sadly.
But I see we're all looking very forward right now, and so I want to take a few steps back. I was listening to a podcast for the first time called You Must Remember This. It's kind of a secret history of Hollywood. And in episode one, they discussed Frank Sinatra's album, I think it's Past, Present, and Future. The first song is called What Time Does the Next Miracle Leave? And it's a 10-minute rambling sort of thing where Frank Sinatra takes a journey into the solar system on this kind of look into the stars, let your imagination wander free and dance on Pluto and have conversations with Saturn. And it's so strange to hear this kind of freewheeling fantasy bit coming out of, you know, old Blue Eyes, the crooner. It's jarring and narcissistic and very out of place and out of time. And it rhymes. It rhymes a lot.
Jupiter makes with the rain, Saturn makes with the crops. A nicer trade was never made, and hopefully never stops. If Saturn's fields are dry, Jupiter won't stay fat. So Jupiter leaves his faucets on, and that is that.
It's a strange little internal vision of, I don't know what the hell.
Had he been talking to L. Ron Hubbard?
I don't know. It was done in 1980, and it was kind of a look back over a very long career. He would have been about 70 at the time, close to it. So it's a retrospective that covers the past, covers the present, and covers the future. And I think kind of unpacking a long and really colorful career. I'm not sure it works, but it's a really interesting curiosity. And both it and the You Must Remember This podcast are definitely worth a listen.
Which, of course, reminded me of another epic space journey, which would be the 2001 release of the spoken rock album by William Shatner, Seeking Major Tom.
Yes. Yeah, that is an important collection. When was that again?
2011. Okay. I may have said 2001. 2011.
Yeah, the image I most remember from that is his version of Bohemian Rhapsody, where Shatner appears as a giant face in the sky, looking over two young lovers and casting down tumbling zodiac symbols and fireballs upon them. And I think that Shatner as Sky God is a fine, fine image.
Truly a shining example of the genre.
Yes.
But no, the music video for Bohemian Rhapsody is a marvel.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's all that we have time and patience for tonight. So I'm going to thank my two co-hosts, and wish you all a happy new year and catch the outro line.
Intro music is Future Club and outro music is Tronicles, both by Sirius Beat. This podcast is copyright 2017 by Radio Free Demos and may be used in any not-for-profit project with appropriate credit and notification. Check out our website, radiofreedemos.com, that's DEIMOS, for more rambling, resources, links to official and fan-driven content, and our full catalog of episodes. And look for us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.